Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
So what I want to do with this talk is to, together with you, think what it means to be a Catholic scientist. And it's sort of in three parts. I'm going to be a little bit autobiographical in the first part, then give you some, what has for me been some very helpful readings from Aquinas, and that's the handout that you maybe have. The handout that you will at some point be given before we get there. Is it there? It will arrive at some point. This is in the second part, so it's fine. And then we'll end with what I hope is some sort of more practical ideas of what you can do to go from being a scientist who's Catholic to sort of a fully integrated Catholic scientist. Now, I'm a little bit self-conscious about using myself as an example, but it is the example I know the best. So that's where I'm going to start, to tell you a little bit about what that journey has been looking like for me. So I'm a convert, and in some sense I'm a double convert, first to Christianity and then into the Catholic Church. So I grew up in many other ways, not the conventional Swedish family, but at least conventional in the way that it was a non-religious one. And that meant that even though I had some sort of, I think, childhood faith that comes from growing up in a culture that is has some deep Christian roots, as well as in a family that held strong to traditions, even if it was not a lot of religious practice, that sort of childhood faith started going away as I started thinking about it more. And that happened as I was a young teenager. But there were still some commitments that I was not willing to give up on, which are not that easy to cohere with a solely materialistic universe. One of them is that of free will. I have always experienced, and I think as all you have as well, that I make choices. And that any sort of ideology or faith that says that that is not real, I'm going to have a very hard time to accept. The other one is that there are things like that morals are real. That there are really things that are good and there are things that are evil, even if there are a lot of things that can be in sort of a muddy gray zone where it's hard for us to figure out, that the universe where that is not a presence just seems to go completely against all of our experiences. That, again, is pretty hard to imagine where that reality or morals should come from in a purely materialistic universe. So those are things that are in the back of my mind as I first arrive to the U.S. as an undergrad and start my sort of professional scientific pursuits. And I did not become a Christian while in college, but I think it's fair to say that there were several seeds that were sown there together with these sort of philosophical commitments that I came in with. One was simply the fact that I, for the first time, was surrounded by really intelligent Christians my age. And I think even though, as I said, like I did not become a Christian at the time, I think that somewhere started to sort of put down an anchor that maybe there was a connection between these philosophical commitments and sort of classical Christianity. That at least it was possible to have sort of this very rational outlook on nature and also be a Christian. And my first sort of bit of encouragement to you, that even just by being sort of known to be a Christian in a predominantly secular environment, you might be sowing seeds that you are never going to find out about what happened to them. And I don't think, I'm not friends still with any of the Christian students that I got to know at Caltech. I don't think what impact they had on me, but certainly I think starting for me, helping me to start and make those connections was a huge impact. Towards the end of my time at Caltech as an undergraduate, I started wearing a small cross that I had gotten from my grandmother. This was not because I had become a Christian. I think it was like trying to sort of recall why I was doing this. It was as a taking sides against atheism. It was like becoming more convinced that sort of purely materialistic, atheistic universe just didn't work out. Now, in wearing this cross, an acquaintance of mine made a very understandable mistake of thinking that I was a Christian and therefore gave me one of C.S. Lewis' books as his gift. So it's Screwtape Letters. If you haven't read it, highly recommend it for Lent. It's a fantastic examination of conscience, especially of those who are sort of intellectually minded and the different sort of traps that we can fall into. I read it. I really enjoyed it. Did not make me a Christian. Then I ordered one of his other books, The Abolition of Man, which is a beautiful summary of exactly these, in some sense, problems that I was having with trying to understand where morality comes from and why it's there. It's a book that is, it's a book that advocates for theism, but not for Christianity directly. And then I made the fatal, at least if you're, from an atheistic point of view, like mistake of ordering mere Christianity, which I did during my first year in grad school. So I ordered it and I started reading it in the morning of a Sunday, my first year in grad school. I had moved to the Netherlands to start my PhD. And as I was reading it, sort of just like plowing through the book, it started to become clearer and clearer to me that I was assenting to what was written in the book. It's a very strange feeling. I don't know how many converts there are among you, but to be that conscious of having sort of your word turned upside down. So I would say it was a somewhat unsettling day. But of course, a very, very beautiful one as well. So at the time, I said I didn't really have any Christian friends and no Christian family. Didn't really know what you're supposed to do. Definitely not in any way thinking about being an integrated sort of Christian scientist. But I knew you're supposed to go to church. So I Googled English-speaking churches in the Netherlands, and I found the Anglican Church in The Hague, which is where I attended for the next 3.5 years. About a year later, one of my brothers, not a Christian, as my family was sort of coming to terms with that this was sticking, decided that if I was going to do this whole Christianity thing, I may as well do it right. So he gave me Chesterton's Orthodoxy to read. And I read it, and I had this kind of, I thought I was stunned, like, why are you doing this to me again, kind of feeling as I was reading it. Because it was so obvious to me as I was reading it that this was the kind of Christianity that I had been imagining all along. I just didn't know how to put words to it until the very brilliant Chesterton helped me see what I was looking for. It was not enough at the time for me to actually convert. I think a combination of that I had a very lovely Anglican parish with an Anglican priest who was sort of too, I'll say, theologically orthodox to fit very well into the main part of the Anglican Church. It was sort of an exile from that, and just a wonderful C.S. Lewis-like kind of figure. But also, I would say, the cultural obstacles. Catholicism has not historically been a very popular thing in Sweden. Our sort of most glorious historical moment is when King Gustavus Adolphus led the Protestants against the Catholics in the 30-Year War and sort of invented modern warfare in the process. And it took me another few years in moving to the U.S. to go from feeling that sort of longing and knowing that I would one day become Catholic to actually taking the step into the Catholic Church. And there were two things that led to that sort of like pushing over the last obstacle. On the one hand, it was sort of the increasing sort of intellectual dissonance that I was feeling within the sort of Protestant and Anglican community, where it seemed that it was quite common that it was okay to say one thing, to say the creeds, but to not actually believe everything that you said, that was sort of not a problem. And to me, that was a huge problem. I think we all have some things that we are just a little bit obsessive about. Like for many scientists, mine is truth. I'm the kind of person who, since I was able to start talking, if somebody says something that's a little bit inaccurate, I will be, and this is like from the age of 3, actually, this is the way it is. And I just have a very hard time staying quiet when there is any untruth or inaccuracy on the table. And that became harder and harder for me to sort of continue to live with. The other was then to actually going into a Catholic church, being present at Mass, and just sensing what was going on there long before I could sort of put any words on it. But it was this extreme sense of homecoming. So I ended up converting in 2012 while still at Harvard, then moved to Virginia for a year where I met the Dominicans. So a very fruitful year, and then moved back to Harvard to join the astronomy faculty in 2013. And there are many things I could say here. I think one of the things that has made it so easy for me to live out, in some sense, my faith, however, as I've come to understand it, I think in a deeper and deeper way, is that I was very open about it from the very beginning. And maybe not in the most prudential way, sort of in hindsight, but as I was being recruited to come back to Harvard, one of the conversations that I had with my chair was that sort of the one thing that was holding me back was that I just found this lovely Catholic community in Charlottesville, and I wasn't really willing to give it up. The next morning, he has rounded up whomever is sort of remotely Catholic in the department, so a few Anglicans in there, and have them send me emails about how lovely it is to be Catholic in Cambridge, not Harvard. So, and that, I think, there's going to be times when you want to be open about your faith. There are going to be times when you want people to get to know you first. I think those are going to be prudential calls. But for me, in some sense, just following the Spirit and being a bit reckless at the beginning, then set it up so I never had to apologize for it later. And whenever I felt that I wanted to do something for the Catholic Church, I felt that I could do it without sort of apology, that the department really knew what they had sort of gotten themselves into from the beginning. It took me quite a few years before I even started thinking about what it should mean to be a Catholic scientist. I think for many years, I was quite content to just do my science like everyone else, while on the other hand, sort of trying to get deeper into my faith. But I think you're going to come to at some point that is not going to be enough. That's going to feel like you're almost like leading two different lives, and you're going to want to start figuring out ways to integrating the two with one of the other, with each other. One of the first things that I was asked to do was by Notre Dame, who has some wonderful summer programming for science and theology high school teachers, was to come and give some lectures on sort of science, like on my science and how that might impact Catholic belief. And I had no idea, in some sense, how it should impact Catholic belief, what I do for science. I never saw that there was any conflict. That just never occurred to me. But in them pushing me to do something that I did not in any way feel ready for, it also forced me to start thinking about what does it mean? Like, why aren't there conflicts? Like, why do I feel that there are no conflicts? What's the sort of theological basis for that? And that was my entryway into starting to use my sort of scientific intuitions and scientific credibility to help the church in thinking through some of these potential or like proposed conflicts between science and religion that often come up. So that was my sort of gateway into thinking more carefully about what it means to be a Catholic scientist rather than the scientist who's Catholic. Over the years, I mean, I have done more of that. You heard about some of the things I do with the Thomistic Institute, but that has, and I still really enjoy doing this. But that over time, even that has not really felt that it's enough. And I think one of the things that's happened to me, especially in the past few years, is that I've also started thinking more carefully about what it means not just to be a Catholic scientist, but a Catholic professor. Sort of a Catholic in the academe in some way. And one of the main things that I think that means is to love your institute long before it's lovable. And if you love your institute and you believe that the truth is to be found in the Catholic intellectual tradition, that's going to mean bringing more of the Catholic intellectual tradition to your institute. Now, that can be done in very small ways, dependent on your current sort of state of life, your profession, whether that is sort of inviting some of your friends to think through how the Catholic intellectual tradition can help address some particular question. But for me in the past few years, that has meant trying to get more speakers to campus that are sort of are serious scholars that Harvard professors can come and listen to and be impressed by. Also to start teaching some courses that address exactly some of these issues. The last one, which I'm teaching again next year, is simply called Catholic Thought for Contemporary Challenges. And just the fact that a place like Harvard is totally okay with letting me teach a course like that should tell you that often I think we're held back by our imagination rather than by the rules of these secular institutions. When I proposed this course, they were like, sure. And they're letting me do it again this upcoming fall without they asked me to do it again. Another thing that it means is just also trying to help the overall climate at your institute, to have it be more friendly to other people, bringing their religious commitments with them into the institute. And to get away from this idea that we should have this separation, that you stop being a Catholic when you go into the classroom or when you go into your scientific pursuits. That does not mean that you want to confuse the different disciplines. The disciplines of theology and of the different sciences and the different humanities do have very different tools and, in some sense, objects that they use for their study. But it does mean that it should be possible to have a coherent sort of worldview where there's some sort of fluidity where you can go back and forth between thinking about the same object from different points of view. And with that, I want to move in to how we can think about this in a bit more general way with the help of Aquinas. But first, I think it's maybe just useful to think about why we do science in the first place. Even if we sort of momentarily think about the sciences apart from our Catholic convictions. I mean, there are two, I would say, very distinct reasons why people tend to end up in the sciences. One is whether it's for secular or Catholic reasons, is because you have some other goal in mind that the sciences can help with. And there are, I think, very good This in some sense is maybe the most obvious way to connect your Catholic faith to your scientific pursuits, that you have some service of humanity in mind. So it's feeding the hungry, clothing the naked, healing the sick, or I should add, teaching the ignorant for us who are our teachers and college professors. I know basically nothing about this. This has never been the reason that I have been doing the sciences. If you have questions on that, if that is where your scientific vocation is pushing you, I'm happy to try to reason them through with you. But instead, what I want to focus on is when you do science in some sense for the sake of discovery, for just understanding the creation that we live in a bit better. And in that sense, like when you're sort of doing science for science's sake, what the vocation there fundamentally is to see the order under the order, is to get to be part of the privilege of tracing out the causes and the orders that explain what most people just get to see sort of on the surface, to be able to go under the surface. And going under the surface might mean that you go from explaining the earth by zooming out. You explain the earth by understanding star and planet formation, by understanding galaxies, by understanding the Big Bang. Or it means by understanding the earth by zooming in on individual cells and seeing the amazing things that's going on in your cells at any time. That is, so it's the vocation of the scientist is to figure that out. This is a little motor protein carrying a vesicle inside of a cell. And we know that if we can go even deeper there, that this order that is present in the cells comes from an even deeper order, which is encoded in our genes. So we get to be the ones who sort of put these pieces of the puzzle together and then show it to others and show just the depth of the order that exists in the world. Now, this is true for all scientists. I think that is what drives most sort of scientists who do fundamental science. So the question is then, okay, where does the Catholicism come into that? Aquinas has a very sort of useful distinction between the work, what he calls the philosopher. You could, for present purposes, you could replace that with scientist, and that of the theologian. So both of them study creation, or at least can. I mean, obviously, theology is ultimately geared towards God, but both of them can study creation. But they do it in different ways. So if you think about what you do as a scientist, you are, see if you are in the middle here, that therefore the philosopher and the faithful Christian consider different points about creatures. The philosopher considers what attaches to them in their proper nature, say natural causes. The faithful Christian considers about creatures only what attaches them to their relation to God, as they are created by God, subject to God, and the like. So remember when we talked about creation being primarily a relationship. So what I would sort of propose to you is the job, in some sense, of the Catholic scientist is to integrate these two ways of exploring creation. Is to be the kind of person who can be a bridge between, like, finding the sort of natural order and natural causes in the world, and at the same time being able to see how they apply to showing forth the glory of God. This is if we were to take who would be our sort of paradigmatic Catholic scientist. I think Monsignor Lemaître would definitely be one of them. And he has a very similar, I would say, a very complementary take on this to Aquinas. So I'm just going to read this quote because it's something that really resonated with how I think about things, in that the Catholic scientist, in some sense, is not doing anything different from the secular or non-Catholic scientist, but we get to do it with our eyes open. We get to know why science should work, why we should expect there to be order. So this is what Lemaître says. Therefore, the Christian scientist goes forward freely, secure in the knowledge that his research cannot conflict with his faith. He has perhaps even a certain advantage over his non-believing colleague. Indeed, both are striving to decipher the manifold complexity of nature in which the various stages of the world's long evolution are overlaid and confused. But the believer has the advantage of knowing that the enigma is solvable, that the underlying scripture is, after all, the work of an intelligent being. One of the things that is very mysterious, and it should be mysterious to a non-believer, is why science works. Why there is an order to be discoverable, why there is something out there which is sort of fundamentally linked to what we can comprehend and make sense of. The Christian scientists, we have many mysteries, but this is not one of them. If we live in a creation that is a creation of a mind, we should expect there to be patterns of intelligibility and comprehension. But if this is our ultimate goal, is to understand God, if that is like, because clearly that's the higher between so understanding creation for creation's sake, why don't we just study God? I mean, I think that's why not be theologians instead of scientists if ultimately you want to understand God? And here's where I want to turn to your handout. We're just going to look at a couple of excerpts so you have the whole thing to read and meditate on later. Because Aquinas says that meditation on the divine works, created order, is indeed necessary for instruction of faith in God. Those are strong words. Doesn't say it's good. It says it's necessary. How can we start to get some intuition of why this should be? I think one way is to go back to sort of the natural order of things. Let's say you were interested in understanding someone like G.R.R. Tolkien. There are several ways you could go about that. One is maybe you could read a biography of him and his interactions with the people around him. Maybe you could talk to some of his surviving relatives who had a direct relationship with him. But another way would be to read Lord of the Rings, that there's a certain way that you would understand aspects of Tolkien that you would not get from talking to his children by reading his creative work. Now, none of those can, of course, replace going and having a direct conversation with Tolkien. And we should never think of replacing the studying of the creation with prayer. In fact, I would argue that we should approach it in a very prayerful way. But I think you can see that you are, by reading Tolkien, there's some, reading Lord of the Rings, you are learning something about Tolkien. So the idea then would be that there's some analogy between that and studying creation, that this is God's creative work, and there's going to be some aspects of him that we can only pick up by studying that. So Aquinas gives four ways in which studying his creation should teach us something about God. And the first is that it gives us some insight into his wisdom. And what it says is, for things made by art are representative of the art itself, being made in likeness to the art. Now God brought things into being by his wisdom, wherefore the psalm declares, you made all things in wisdom. Hence, from reflection upon God's works, we are able to infer his wisdom, since by a certain communication of his likeness, it is spread abroad in the things that he has made. And here, we're thinking about things like the incredible order that is present in the universe. I already showed you a little bit of this movie, but I think it is worth again pondering how powerful these ordering principles are, and how amazing it is that there are actually that we can decode those patterns. That there is again that order out there that also corresponds to the created order within. This is a bit of a sort of sidebar, so I just want to throw it out there, and we can do more in the Q&A. When we think about what the sort of laws of nature are that are revealed through this order, there are different ideas about how to think about them. The three most popular: divine commands, basically the laws are doing the work. You fall to the earth because of the law of gravity. Second one, there's real powers, causal powers in created things. That's how Aristotle and Thomas Aquinas would think about it. You fall to the ground because earth is curving space. That's more a second way to think about it. I think the most reasonable. And the final one is that it's all a fiction, sort of a useful fiction. This is sort of the Humean way that all we can know is that there are, if A, then B happened. We cannot infer there's a real sort of true relationship between the two. Whichever one you want to pick, except for the third, which doesn't make sense. Well, it's like, if the third is true, then we're living in a truly mysterious universe where it just happens that over and over again, the same things like happen in sort of an organized and pattern ordered way, even though there's no actual causal connection between things. There's a long tradition that Aquinas builds upon. We already touched upon this a bit earlier, that if we understand the order and laws of the universe, we get to know something about the lawmaker. So this goes back to the Psalms, right, to the Old Testament, that the heavens declare the glory of God. So this is not something that's sort of a theological invention, even though it was a theological refinement. The second thing is that Aquinas thinks that this is a path towards better understanding just how sublime God's power is. I think this is actually something that has gotten even more powerful as science has revealed just within the natural order of things, the immensity of the powers we're dealing with and their complexity. And Aquinas rightly says that for the power of the worker is necessarily understood to transcend the things made. So if we start thinking about things like galaxies, stars forming, even the Big Bang itself, and understanding that to happen sort of within, that these are the works, then how much more impressive is the creator of those works? And if you want sort of another little meditation to bring with you, I find it very moving to, in the same sort of, to keep in my mind at the same time the thoughts of the creator of this becoming a child in this world. Like that sort of juxtaposition of the creator of this immensity becoming this sort of vulnerable human being to save us. But we shouldn't get too obsessed about the scales of things. Like the Big Bang is definitely an icon of the sort of the sublimity of God's power. But so it is if we look into the biological world. I mean, his power also caused this weird thing that's camouflaging against the leaves. And I think it's good, again, to keep in mind, going back to the Old Testament, that God is not present in the thunder and the earthquake, even however sort of impressive those seemed to Elijah, but he was present in the quiet whisper. And that often when we look for the sublimity of God's power, we'll find it just as much in the little things that we study as in the big things. The third thing that Aquinas wants us to notice is that studying creation should incite the love of God's goodness. That it is in sort of in observing nature and uncovering the deeper orders and deeper layers of beauty, we should be turning to God in gratitude and in love. For whatever goodness and perfection is distributed to the various creatures, in partial or particular measure, is united together in him universally. If therefore the goodness, beauty, and delightfulness of creatures are so alluring to the minds of men, the fountainhead of God's own goodness, compared to the rivulets of goodness found in creatures, will draw the enkindled mind of men wholly to itself. St. Leo the Great says something similar, that nature itself is a lesson for the faithful in the worship of God. The heavens, the sea, and all that is in them bear witness to the goodness and omnipotence of their Creator, and the marvelous beauty of the elements as they obey him demands from the intelligent creation a fitting expression of gratitude. Nature has always been gorgeous, but I would argue that it has never been more beautiful than sort of contemporary science has revealed to us. So it also a scientific pursuit is a pursuit of beauty. This being one, a couple of recent images from the James Webb Space Telescope showing us what space looks like when we are turning sort of dark, not dark, dark matter, but non-luminous matter into stars. The final, and maybe the most in some sense provocative reason that Aquinas gives for why studying nature is a path to God, and in some sense a unique path to God, is it endows men with a certain likeness to God's perfection. By knowing himself, God beholds all other things in himself. Since then, the Christian faith teaches man principally about God and makes him know creatures by the light of divine revelation. There arises in man a certain likeness of God's wisdom. So it is said, but we all beholding the glory of the Lord with open face are transformed into the same image. So there's a sense in which trying to see creation as God sees creation is something that is divinizing. And that is, again, something that I would just put before you as something that's bringing with you both in your work as well as in your meditations. That there is a way that we're sort of participating in almost a creative act by this kind of careful uncovering of the order in creation. So I want to end with a couple of thoughts, like one in some sense addressing maybe a worry, and then to some practical points. So what I've said so far should make you think that it's kind of natural for scientists to be Catholic, to be Christian. There is a natural connection between the two. And thus should we then expect that studying creation, being a scientist, always leads to God? In some fundamental way, that has to be the case. You are studying God's creation, but it's very clear if we look around us in the academy that there's only a minority that are just conscious of what they are doing. So how can you miss, as a scientist, being Catholic, if you are spending all this time seeing the wisdom, the ordering of the universe, seeing the power, seeing the beauty, and even maybe having some sort of semi-mystical experiences as you're doing this? I mean, I think this sense of awe and wonder is very common in the good scientist. There are places to start thinking about this. One is from Saint Basil. I'll just read the highlighted parts. So these men, philosophers, scientists, I say, have discovered all except one thing, the fact that God is the creator of the universe. So for a long time, we have known that you can find out a whole lot of things. And he's talking mainly about astronomers here, which is extra nice, people who measure the stars and so on. And he acknowledges that also in his time, that was not the sure path to Christianity. And the Book of Wisdom goes a bit further in trying to provide an explanation for why this is. So this whole section is wonderful. So Wisdom 13, 1-9. So highly recommend it for study. But the seventh verse here. for they search busily among his works, but are distracted by what they see, because the things seen are fair. It is possible, as a scientist, to just get caught up in studying creation and being distracted by the many beautiful things you see there, and not taking a step back and asking where it all comes from. And I think these two together gives us some place to start. Why it doesn't seem like more people are falling, what I would say is the natural trajectory from creation to creator. Okay, so where I want to finish with is just a couple of thoughts on what has been helpful for me in going on this journey and thinking about how to make your scientific pursuits Catholic scientific pursuits. And like a good Thomist, I have a list. So let's just walk through this list and then go into Q&A. The first thing is that there are so many places you need to bring prayer to. Praying, like if you end up being a professor, praying for your students. I mean, this just objectively works. I can tell you just how much fruitful the scientific pursuits and the relationships you have are when you pray for your colleagues, your fellow students, for the students that you teach. But also to pray for your scientific pursuits, especially to not fall into that trap that wisdom warned us about, that we can become distracted by just the beautiful, delightful things that we see and forget to always remember that what we are ultimately observing is a relationship between the creation and creator. Disciplining ourselves in the virtues. Especially intellectual virtues, but I think one of the things that tradition teaches, including Thomas, is that you can't really have one without the other. So even if we are thinking about what are the intellectual virtues, things like intellectual humility, and in that sense, like the good kind of curiosity, you're not going to be able to cultivate those if you don't at the same time cultivate the moral virtues like honesty, for example. But if there's anything that should be the focus of the scientist, of the fundamental scientist, it is the pursuit of truth. And to basically discipline yourself in a world full of temptation and very hard competition to keep your eyes on that. And or if you're in the applied sciences on love, on caritas, on service. And even when you're trying to make prudential calls, to always keep those front and center. Of course, not disconnected from prayer. Of in some sense, keeping the creation, to take creation very seriously, but your pursuit, your scientific pursuit of understanding of that creation, to hold that lightly. And the thing not to hold lightly is the infinitude of the people around you that are your sort of co-pursuers. When I think about what it means to be in an academe and to be sort of a Catholic in the academy, it is to recall that what the university is a kind of civic friendship that is ordered towards the pursuit and transmission of truth. And that means that friendship is if you forget about that or take that out of focus, the pursuit of truth will eventually go away as well, or at least not happen in the way you would hope to. The fourth one is to do what you're doing now, to familiarize yourself with a tradition, to set up a habit of studying it, so that you can be not just the scientist who sees this sort of natural order and the immensity and beauty of that, but starts developing sort of a habit of mind of also seeing the creator in his creation. And I think that is when you can become that sort of, you can, that glue between the natural order and the divine order and help other people also see it. Fifth one is to love the place you're at. Being at the secular academy, As a practicing Catholic, it's not always going to be an easy thing. It's not always going to be set up in a way that's the easiest for you to practice your faith. And yet we are called not to love things abstractly, but to love our neighbor. And that means also setting up an environment where our neighbors can thrive. And to think about what service, in some sense, you owe to the place that you are at and the people that are there. And that often that kind of service is harder than sort of more abstract services to larger communities. And so to bringing all of this together then is to think of ways to bring the Catholic intellectual tradition in small or large ways, but I would say be ambitious, into your scholarly and teaching pursuits. And here I think as students, you actually have in some sense more agency than you might think. The reason that I'm teaching this first year seminar on the Catholic intellectual tradition is because I was pushed there by a group of undergraduate students who came to me. Well, actually, they went to like 10 different professors. And I think I was the only one who was didn't realize that that Harvard would say no, but then they didn't say no. So I think often students can have a certain, you know, you don't know what's allowed and not allowed at the institute as professors think they do. And sometimes you can give people like the push that they need to try something new. So I think if you imagine something that would be great, pursue it and help your professors to get the courage to pursue it with you. And with that, I am happy to take any questions on this or the previous seminar.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.